This is Sheila Follett, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this morning, I'm talking to James Randi, former magician and president of the James Randi Educational Foundation, and our topic is atheism. James Randi, glad to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Perhaps it would help the listener, before we begin talking about exactly what your views are, if you'd give a little bit of information about your background and how you came to establish this foundation.
Well, I was born some 70 years ago, and in between point zero and 70, I learned a few things along the way. One of them was the trade of magic, that is, prestidigitation, conjuring, whatever you wish to call it. I was a magician for many decades of my life, up until about the age of 50. At that point, I began to realize that I was accumulating other sort of expertise that enabled me to tell the difference between fraud and fact. I was being able to detect chicanery in others while I did it as entertainment. I found out that there were scams and swindles of various kinds, particularly the so-called psychics who claim that they have all sorts of mystical divine powers whereby they can read minds or fly through the air or whatever you wish. And I was easily able to see through those fraudulent practices, and I began to lecture on the subject. Now I'm a full-time lecturer and, as you said, president of the James Randi Educational Foundation here in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. We pursue critical thinking on behalf of children. We try to get teachers and educational systems to adopt critical thinking modes, and we bring classrooms into the foundation, and we go out to visit classrooms to lecture on the subject of critical thinking about the so-called paranormal, occult, and supernatural. And I travel with a substantial prize behind me, a prize of $1 million called the Pegasus Prize, that is offered to anyone anywhere in the world who can provide evidence of any paranormal, occult, or supernatural event under proper observing conditions. It's that simple. That goes to the astrologers, the therapeutic touch people, the acupuncturists, chiropractors, anybody who has something they say they can prove actually works, but which is on the edges of science, fringe science, if you will. I travel all over the world. I'm on my way to Costa Rica in a few days, in a couple of months on my way to China, and let me see, where else? Well, Hungary and Germany, and a big conference in Italy later on this year. So I do get around the globe.
Now, what I'd like to do is to turn this directly to the topic today, and our topic is atheism. I assume that your experience in exposing what you call as scams and your interest in critical thinking are somehow tied up with your adherence to atheism. So perhaps you could give us a sort of snapshot view of your reasons for being an atheist, then we can look at those arguments in more detail.
Well, my reasons for being an atheist are simple enough. I just simply don't see any compelling evidence to believe in deities of any kind, male or female or androgynous, of any culture, any race, any philosophy. I don't see that we should have to invent gods for things that we don't understand and can't presently explain. Since the concept of if gods first arose, and that must have been many tens of thousands of years ago, with our species, many things have become explained. We don't have a rain god any longer, at least we in this civilization as we know it don't have a rain god, because we understand quite thoroughly what causes rain. But we still have a god who promises us immortality and rewards and paradise and whatnot, things that I find untenable. I find them unacceptable. They are not necessary for my philosophy to explain the world as much as I possibly can. That doesn't mean that there aren't mysteries that sort of beleaguer all of us. We'd all like to have answers to mysteries, but to invent deities in order to explain them, I think, is juvenile.
Okay, so you say there's just no evidence. That's sort of foundation of your atheism. Certainly, a lot of people would say, but wait a moment, isn't there just evidence all around us? I mean, the fairly common argument is sometimes called the argument from design, that the world is very complex, it's sufficiently complex that we couldn't explain it were it not for the presence of a deity. I take it that doesn't convince you. Could you try to say why not?
Well, not at all. As I'm sitting here at my desk at the foundation, I'm looking at a poster on the wall. Special lecture introduced by Professor Richard Dawkins, Pursuing the Chimera with James Randi. That was a talk I gave a few months ago at Oxford University in England, and Richard Dawkins is a well-known writer and philosopher and scientist. He has written a book called The Blind Watchmaker, which handles that problem, if you call it a problem, very adequately, and I heartily suggest that people who have this question on their minds obtain a copy of the book, either from the bookstore or from the library. It's called The Blind Watchmaker by Richard Dawkins, D-A-W-K-I-N-S. Highly recommended, and it can certainly handle much better than I can in the short span of time we have here, the problem of design. It appears when we look at the world as if it has to have been designed by some sort of intelligence, but that isn't necessarily so. We are relying on our experience, our limited experience of the immediate world in a small time segment that we occupy during our lives in order to make that judgment. I think Dawkins outlines it very well.
Could you give, I mean, obviously we can't go into it in enormous detail, but I wonder if you could even take a minute, minute and a half here to briefly explain to the listener why the appearance of design is not a sufficient reason to believe in a deity.
Well, because we are given almost infinite time for a species to develop from very simple one-celled creatures, and we just simply can't accept or even give any value or honor to the often thrown about canard that man is supposed to have descended from apes. No, that was never claimed by the evolutionists, never, under any circumstances. It's a canard invented by the creationists who would like to make it part of the mythology that they tell about people who believe in evolution. It is inescapable that given enough time and enough combinations and permutations of molecules and atoms in order to make molecules, that certain basic forms of life are going to develop, and that those forms of life are going to refine themselves and in most cases will be more and more sophisticated, while at the same time the vast majority of the new species, the new varieties that come along, die out because they're not viable. It's the ones that lived, the ones that survived, that we see today. And they are very complex. We hear often the story about, well, how could an organ as very sensitive and complex and sophisticated as the eye ever develop by accident? It didn't develop by accident. It developed by a process called evolution, which is a series of experiments that nature plays by repetition, with billions and billions of experiments happening every second for many billions of years. It has to refine itself if there's anything to this survivability of this particular species. And of course, if there isn't, the species vanishes. All we have is the successes of billions and billions of experiments down through the years. That's all we have to show for it. But what we have to show for it is things like Sophia Loren and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
You've provided a reason, a sort of synopsis of the view of why the design argument doesn't work, and you've tried to say that the basic reason why you're an atheist is that you just don't see any evidence. Would that mean, or is it fair to say that means that you think that people who are theists are stupid or uninformed? How would you describe it? How would you explain the fact that so many people do seem to be theists?
I think uninformed, because as a good friend of mine in New York City pointed out to me just a couple of years ago, and in one succinct statement, I think the reason that people believe these things, by and large, is that they don't really understand how the real world works. There's a lot in that simple statement. The real world is a mechanistic world. It's electrical, it's electromagnetic in nature, it's physical in nature, it actually works. It's a large machinery, a very complex machinery made that way by the evolutionary process. And that includes the organisms that are here and the geology of the planet that we live on. I think that most people have very, very little knowledge about that sort of thing. And when they start to investigate it, they're absolutely dumbfounded. They're confused and confounded. They're overrun by the problem. If they understood a little better some of the mechanics of how the real world works, they would understand the process much better.
Okay, so part of it is simply that
they're uninformed.
In fact, use the language you used earlier. You talked about there being mysteries in the world, things that we can't explain, and you acknowledge that there are such things.
Well, not that we can't explain, not that we can't explain at this moment.
Okay. And perhaps then part of your point is that even some of the explanations that are there now are not explanations that many of the people in the street would know or understand.
And they also may be explanations that are not quite correct. You look at Newton compared to Einstein. Now, Newton came up with F equals UT plus half AT squared, the simple law of motion of bodies, falling bodies and whatnot, and that covers the world very nicely, as Newton knew it. But he didn't know about subatomic particles, which don't obey those laws at all, or about things as large as galaxies and quasars and black holes. They don't obey those laws either. But then when we get into relativity, which is Einstein, and quantum physics, which is a large group of people beyond Einstein, we begin to understand how these things are explained. And S equals UT plus half AT squared is not wrong. It's simply buried in all the more complex theories and equations that express really how the world works. Newton wasn't wrong. He just covered a more limited aspect of the universe, a smaller part of the spectrum. So science corrects itself as it goes along. That's something that things like religion don't do. They never correct themselves. They make up dogmas. Those dogmas are established. They're axioms. They don't go anywhere beyond that. They just simply say, this is true and always will be true, and I don't want to hear any discussion about it. I think that's very closed-minded, and I think that that science really has the attitude that we should be going after, which is, show me. I want to know more.
Let me, I want to pursue this a little bit further, but let me pause for the benefit of anyone who may have tuned in late. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest this morning is James Randi, former magician and president of the James Randi Educational Foundation in Florida. And our topic today is atheism. All right, there's another way which we've talked some about the arguments for the existence of God, why people think they might have evidence. The other way which people often go when they describe why they are theists is they will say or talk about faith. How would you understand claims about faith if people make them? How do you evaluate them? You have any comment there?
Define your term for me.
Well, I don't know. I'm just repeating the sort of language that people use. I mean, I guess the basic idea is that the average person who uses the language will say there are mysteries in the world, there are things we can't explain, that we have to have some kind of faith either to provide that explanation, to provide meaning in life, to provide morality, whatever it might happen to be.
Well, people say that I have no faith. I have more faith than the average person, I think, but it's not the kind of faith that they have. There are only two varieties of faith, so far as I see it, blind faith and reasoned faith. I have reasoned faith in the probability, the very strong probability, that the sun will rise again tomorrow, as it always has. That is, that the earth will rotate in the direction of the sun, and the sun will appear to rise off the horizon. I know that from past experience, and I know that it's been going on for many millions of years, and I expect that it will go on for many millions more. I do that based on reason and expectation and past experience. But blind faith is, oh, I'm going to live forever. I just know it. When I die, I won't really die. I'll go someplace else. There. I don't want to think anything more about that. I've just decided that's the way it is. I've decided that's what I'm going to accept. That's blind faith, because there is no evidence for that whatsoever. The kind of faith that I have is faith based upon evidence. I have faith in my friends. I have faith in the chair that I'm sitting on. I've been sitting on this for many years now. It hasn't collapsed yet. When it does collapse, my faith will be broken in this chair, and I'll either get a new one or I'll fix it. But faith is a very useful part of our lives, of course, if it's based upon experience and upon evidence.
Now, let's turn to one other sort of thing. This one may actually be straight in your ballpark, that other people, when they talk about their beliefs, will say they've had certain experiences, that they've seen God work, that prayer has been answered. As a former magician, I mean, how do you evaluate these sorts of claims? What do you have to say about them?
Let's handle their prayers have been answered. What percentage of their prayers have been answered? That's always the question that I ask, and they say, oh, always. I never have any failure that way. What do you pray for? Do you pray that you'll have enough food to put on the table tomorrow, and you do have it? But that's largely due to your own efforts, is it not? Yes, but it's possible that I might not have found the food or might not have had the money to buy the food. That's all possible, too. These people are very selective in their thinking. I know of people, for example, I was just on a major television show a couple of weeks ago where a gentleman practicing the art of Qigong from China said that he was 100% correct, that he could always broadcast healing power to people who had aches and pains or problems of various kinds, that he could broadcast healing power to them and they would always be able to feel it. So we put five people in chairs and in front of them, and they were blindfolded, and one of them was chosen at random. The person chosen didn't know that he or she was chosen. The only person who knew in the room was the healer himself, and he directed his attention towards that particular person. And when the blindfolds were taken off, they were all asked if they'd felt any improvement. Most of them said they felt some improvement. I think that's because of TLC, that somebody was paying attention to them. But on the average, over the day, he got one out of five correct, which is exactly what we would expect by chance. But this man had told us in advance that he had never failed in his life, and he was a man beyond middle age, that he'd been doing this since he was a teenager, that he had 100% success always. 100% means not one failure. And he said, that's true. Well, he just had four failures out of five. And that didn't shake up the people who were there. They asked for his business card because they wanted to take him on as a healer, which shows that people don't watch the evidence, they don't listen to the evidence very much. So here we have a perfect example of the kind of thing that it just dismays me to see people accepting this kind of thing, of other people making statements that they cannot support and yet going merrily on their way. Nothing seems to faze them. They're the unsinkable rubber ducks.
All right. I mean, I don't know anything about this particular phenomenon, but there's an interesting question here. I mean, there's a chance, I suppose you might say, he's just a charlatan. That is, he knew that what he was doing didn't work. He was doing it just to make money. But I'm assuming that that often doesn't happen, that this individual might well believe, even deeply believe, that he has healing powers. Now, how do you explain that? How can you explain, given what you said, it appeared that there was no evidence at all that he had these healing powers,
right,
and yet he seemed firmly convinced by it. Is there some kind of explanation of this?
Because he told us that was not the way he should be tested, that he should look at a person, project his healing power towards them, then ask them if they felt better. Now, by suggestion alone, they can feel better. In order to please the healer who is putting forth his best efforts from the far-off land of Asia, that he is doing these wonderful things to try to help them, of course the answer is likely to be, yes, I do feel somewhat better. But in a double-blind test such as that we conducted, we showed that this was all imaginary, that was subjective. It was something that the people felt within themselves when it wasn't necessarily real, because the person who had the healing directed towards them didn't feel a thing. So we have to examine these things in a scientific manner. I hear people say all the time, I've made prayers, and I've never had one of my prayers refused. But I find that very difficult to believe, because if I then ask them to pray for something, they say, oh, no, it has to be something that originates with me. It has to be something that had a real positive need. But look at the prayers that went up from Dachau and Auschwitz. Look at the millions of people who prayed that they would not die, and they did die viciously, cruelly, savagely, and they prayed not to die. Where was God at that time? We can easily say, oh, but God works in mysterious ways. He had his own reason for doing that. That's a rationalization that I find very difficult to accept.
All right, let me ask this. Just given what you said, it seems to me that your way of trying to understand, explain, and discount these phenomena primarily are that individuals engage in selective attention and remembrance. That is, they notice what they want to notice that seems to support their case, and tend to ignore things that count against it, that individuals are suggestible, that they'll simply take the idea or the suggestion or the proposal that something is going to work out well, mm-hmm. and believe it, and third, that these aren't legitimate experiments because they're done in ways that cannot be falsifiable. There's no potential evidence at all that would count against them. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, let me turn in a slightly different direction for a few minutes. I mean, what we've been doing is trying to explain why you're an atheist, and what that generally means in this culture is explaining why you don't believe in God. And so you got to look at the arguments that other people give. One of the concerns, though, that people sometimes have is they say, look, if individuals who are atheists, they can't be moral. You got to have God to be moral.
So I'm
assuming that part of your account of atheism is a more positive account, how it is that atheism integrates into an individual's life, into their understanding of themselves, their place in the world, their relationships with other individuals, including morality. Could you say a little bit about what that might be for an atheist?
But the assumption is, and it's such an insulting assumption. I get people asking me all the time, but if you don't believe in heaven and hell, why would you live a moral life? What they are really saying in that statement is, if I didn't have to fear hell, I would steal, I would rape, I would assault, I would kill, I would do all of those things that I just love to do to some people and under some situations. I'd get away with anything that I could, but no, I fear going to hell and I want to go to heaven, therefore I go by the rules. I find that so insulting that they can't conceive of an individual who has a morality which is based upon doing the right thing because of our obligations, I think the built-in, the hardwired obligations. We have, I believe, several orders of obligation. The first obligation is to survive yourself as an individual. The second thing is that your family, the people closest to you, those related to you that bear the similar DNA strains and whatnot, that they should survive as well. So that's very important to the average person. And next is the species itself, which largely shares a lot of your DNA and a lot of your characteristics. I think these are natural things that nature builds into the species by evolutionary processes, and beyond that, I think a reverence for life in general and the ecology of the planet. Those are things which are natural. And for someone to insult me by saying they don't believe I can be a moral person because I don't fear going to hell is such a gross insult that I just turn away from these people. There's no hope for them.
Okay. How would all this, the related part, when people sometimes talk about it, they say, well, what kind of meaning could your life have? Could you say anything about how an atheist understands the notion of having a meaningful life?
Looking at a newborn baby, holding up a puppy dog, watching a sunset, these are all beautiful phenomena of nature, things to enjoy. A good Beethoven sonata, for example, in a good concert hall with pleasant, sensible people around me. Oh, what a great delight that is. I find absolute delight and pleasure and enjoyment in these things. And it doesn't hurt me to support foster parents plan, which now just called child plan, I think it's called, which I have done for some 35 years now, knowing that when a small check is sent off every month that some kid someplace who wouldn't have a bowl of rice is going to have a bowl of rice because I spent a small amount of my income just to help that kid. That's a great deal of self-satisfaction. Oh, yes, it's smug. It's not altruistic. It's a feeling of comfort because you did something good this day. There's a great deal of satisfaction in that. Don't think that I can't have that satisfaction and that I don't have it every day of the year.
Okay, we've got just about 4 minutes left. What I'd like to do is now turn back and talk a little bit about this idea of the importance of critical thinking skills, which seems to play such an important role, and certainly is part of the mission of your foundation. When you say critical thinking skills, what exactly does that imply, and how does a person inculcate those?
Instead of accepting things that are published in the media or because they appeared on Oprah or because someone wrote a bestseller book about it, look into these things. Investigate them. Start from the bottom. Go to the library and look up the opposite point of view, perhaps, and put them side by side. I don't know how many people have come by the foundation or have run into me in various parts of the world and in various cultures and various languages and have said that reading something that I wrote or hearing me say something or seeing me on a television program in some cases turned their thinking processes around. I don't think you can possibly imagine how rewarding that is. It's enormously rewarding, and that's the kind of thing that I mean by critical thinking. Getting people to think about these things rather than merely accept what the flacks out there would have them believe. They've got to remember that things like Michael Jackson, for example, brilliant musician, but he's not one person. He's a whole organization of over 800 people that are paid constantly out of his revenues in order to keep that figure, that thing called Michael Jackson, in the limelight and keep it healthy and keep it viable. It's not just one person. One person doesn't do this. There are organizations out there running the 1-900 psychic lines. There are organizations out there called churches and temples and various other names of a similar nature that are big, big businesses, and they must promote themselves and they must survive, and they're doing it at your expense. Think about that.
Okay, I take it, too, that your challenge, I mean, to go back and remind the listener if they forgot, that your organization has a $1 million challenge to anyone who can prove a miracle, some sort of supernatural.
Any paranormal, occult, or supernatural event.
Okay, and would that be open? I mean, I take it in the past, most of the people who've taken up the challenge have been the people involved in what are called more occult or paranormal. But is this open to churches as well?
Oh, absolutely. I offered it to the faith healers for one case of healing brought about by the intervention of a faith healer. One. Just one. And to the Christian Scientists, too. One healing brought about by a Christian Science practitioner. One. Just one. Uno, eins, ern. One. That's all. And that will win the $1 million prize. But they don't come anywhere near me, because I think that in their heart of hearts, they know very well it doesn't work. Of course, they can smugly say, oh, God doesn't need to be examined. This man's only a magician. Yeah, but I'm a magician with $1 million that I'll give to you instantly in negotiable bonds, deposited with Goldman Sachs in a special account in New York City. I think that gives me a different stature.
Okay. When you say, I mean, how many people have at least tried to take you up on the challenge?
It's very difficult to put figures on it. It's been many hundreds, but I've got books here sitting across the office from me, staring at me like malevolent spirits, believe me. They are books full of sort of half-completed applications, half-hearted attempts to start getting into the process of designing the tests. Over 700 people have actually been tested over the years, but whether or not they actually, there are thousands, many thousands more than that have applied. Whether they actually get down to sign the papers, make the agreement, decide what they can do or not do, what the statistics will be, how successful they'll be, etc. These are very difficult things to pin these people down to. You'd think it'd be very simple, like running a race, but it's much more complicated than that.
So part of the problem is that many people don't even want to continue to complete the application, and if they do, they don't really want to specify what would count as evidence for and against their claim.
That's right. I get letters from people, well, in the Soviet Union, it's very popular now to say that they've reorganized the solar system, that it turns around Jupiter instead of the sun now. And, of course, these are the kind of things that we don't even consider. I just send them a letter of rejection right away. This is a scientific theory which is not borne out by the facts and the observations. But there are other people who say they make the sun rise every day, and they say, can you prove to me that I don't make the sun rise every day through a power of my will? I said, yeah, shoot yourself, and if it rises tomorrow, I'll send you the money right away.
Okay, 20-second summary on why you're an atheist.
20-second summary. Right. Boy, I just don't find sufficient evidence out there that would make me create or maintain the belief in a deity of any sort.
All right, thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
Good pleasure.
This is Hugh LaFava, Fridays and Issues. I've been talking today with James Randi, former magician and president of the James Randi Educational Foundation. Good day.